Welcome to stop three in this really beautiful spot. So we've been talking at the first couple of stops about how ecology deals with the study of whole systems, and then kind of making that a little more specific there in the second stop, how we think about cycles and patterns of flow through those systems. As we think about these flows and the other various ways in which things manifest in these systems, not even that we've talked about in terms of flow so far, we can start reflecting on this, following the ecologist, in terms of balance, and in terms of what brings a balance around some midpoint in these systems. So we talk about what are, in fancy technical language, called homeostatic systems. So the easy example there, before we even get to like natural systems so much, is just thinking about the thermostat in your house, right? The thermostat does not keep your house at one specific fixed temperature. Sure, you set it to 72 or whatever, but that means that when it gets down to about 70, the thermostat says, hey, furnace, turn on now and warm the house. And then when it gets up, not to 72, but to 73 or 74, the thermostat says, hey, that's enough now, furnace, and let it get back. So the temperature in your house fluctuates around that set point of 72. It's never always sitting right there. But the system is such that it never is able to get too far away from that point of balance. That's how other things are going to work in natural systems. So I think about animal populations, right? I think about, deer grazing on a mountain, to take Leopold's example from the little chapter, Thinking Like a Mountain, right? If the population of deer explodes past a certain point, they're going to overgraze the land, and that's going to bring the deer population crashing back down again. And then hopefully the grazing will recover, the deer population will recover with it. You know, we could think about more complex predator-prey things, where now, the predators of the deer likewise are going to do well and then starve. And then all of these are going to take this dance around these dynamic midpoints, these dynamic points of balance. So note how in those examples, an imbalance in one place gets corrected by then imbalancing a different place, which then gets corrected, and so on. So the deer population getting too big leads to a shrinking of the low-growing herbage that the deer are able to graze. As that goes down and gets out of balance, the deer population, diminishes, and then the grazing plants are able to recover. So we're getting these multiple things affecting each other's balance to bring each other all to kind of dance around some midpoint or other. So, thinking about those kind of things, notice how each imbalance affects a different element in the system. So, thinking about more traditional, Leopold is certainly an important philosopher, but Aristotle, going back 2,000 and some years before, emphasizes this notion of a balance around finding the right midpoint. And so as we think about all of these things, I'd like to actually come back to Henry's example from the end of the last stop, right? So Henry invited us to reflect on, what happens when we suppress certain parts of ourselves. Right, we kind of dam up certain kinds of modes of expression. So I'm here thinking about, to take maybe a slightly provocative and vivid example, but we're all good with that. I'm thinking about the late Victorian period, like the end of the 1800s, into the early 1900s even, when you just, in English-speaking countries at least, you did not think or talk or mention in any way sex in polite company. You just didn't do it. To the point that you put little starched iron skirts around the legs of your piano, lest they scandalize anyone. I am not making this up.
Whoa.
Like, because those little curvy legs in the piano might be a little too sexual.
Oh my God.
It's during that period, too, that the word rooster was invented.
The word what?
Rooster?
Mm-hmm.
Because you couldn't just call it something else.
Oh, got it.
Cockroach becomes a roach.
Yeah. Right. And so I'm not sure if that one happened then or not. Did it?
No, but there's not at that time, but the same kind
same
of,
idea.
Yeah.
But look at what happens then. You dam all these things up, and then Sigmund Freud turns up on the scene to be concerned about all the mental imbalances we're getting through this repression of sexuality and the potentially unhealthy ways that's coming out. And then that's followed immediately by the sexual revolution, where from a generation or two ago, where nothing goes, all of a sudden anything goes, more or less. We get this swinging of the pendulum from one extreme, whooshing back past the midpoint to the other, and then maybe eventually settling in on a balance point of some kind or another. I think about this in other ways too. So I think about that as one example in human life of these kind of things. So we build up and then we let loose in this kind of powerful way of various kinds. Yeah, Marisa.
There's something that comes to mind maybe that mirrors this. I'm thinking about the birth of rock and roll.
Oh, great.
Censorship, like pretty severe censorship that's going on across the board in a number of areas, and then in the background sort of percolating against this censorship, you have blues and jazz working its way into rock, and then all of a sudden, bam! And so I wonder sometimes, would we actually get these wonderful art forms without this sort of heels stepping on something so much and this sort of repression?
Yeah.
I don't know. But.
So I mean, across the board, I don't know that we have to call it like heel stepping repression. I don't know that it has to be hostile or negative. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about the way in which I was just remarking to Joseph on the way up a little bit ago about how a couple of weeks ago I was out on the East. Is that your name?
Daniel.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Six letters that shortens to three letters.
Yeah.
Right? Six letters that shortens to three letters by cutting off the last three. Like, that's the template. I'm sorry, Daniel. I was talking to Daniel on the way up about how, you know, I was out here all the month of July here in Montana, living at like 5,000 feet and change, getting really accustomed to that climate. And then I went out east and started hiking right at sea level. And oh boy, could I rock some of that hiking. I had so much oxygen available to me. It's not that I was punishing myself by being here in Montana at higher altitude, far from it. But by pushing to one extreme, it then set me up for a very useful rebound in a different way, in a different setting. The way that like athletes do high altitude training in more extreme ways. So there are going to be ways to work with this kind of effect very deliberately. Think about how intermittent fasting works, right? It's not that you hate food or your body or any of these kinds of things, but by taking a day or two or whatever periodically to only drink liquids and not have solid food, that can reset your digestion and help it to get back into a balance point that it wasn't in. By pushing to the one extreme, you can come back the other way and then eat healthily and find that balance in your gut or in your metabolism in general if it's been out of kilter. But keeping on fasting, problems. Fairly obvious problems, right? So that's why I don't want to have to have it be in terms of repression. I think there are ways to use this effect deliberately. And I think there are ways in which it happens even when it's not deliberate. Right? So we might be able to think about some of those kinds of things as well. It's like, what else has these balance points? Right? So even think about that population example, right? Say I want to have more deer in my ecosystem for whatever reason. Say that I'm interested in having that. Or say I have too many deer in my ecosystem. I'm concerned that my shrubs are getting so overgrazed. They might just be grazed to the point that the mountain can't regenerate them, because as all the plants die, the soil will run off, and I'm worried about that. So as a wildlife manager, I want to do something to make sure that I keep enough perennial rooted plants growing here, that I don't lose the soil, and that I can get back to a balance point again in my lifetime, and not on the geological span it would take if I lose the topsoil. Say that I desire that. One thing I could do is try to frantically plant more shrubs. Respond directly to the thing that I want to fix the balance of. But that's really not going to help. The deer are just going to keep eating all of those shrubs too, and keep reproducing to the point that they keep eating those shrubs. But I could do other things. I could change the balance of other kinds of predators that are in the ecosystem to the deer. I could either introduce more tags and more hunting licenses for human hunters, or I could bring back or encourage in whatever ways other mammals that are going to prey on those deer. I could bring in wolves or other kinds of creatures into the ecosystem to, by bringing down what's pressuring the the shrubs, let the shrubs rebound.
So rather than a head-on response, it's sort of a bypass or an alternate path
yeah.
to address.
Precisely because these imbalances cascade through various other parts of the system. Mm-hmm. I don't have to address the point where I perceive the problem. I can push something else to change its balance somewhere in the system, mm-hmm. and that will trickle back to change the thing that I'm worried about.
Does this also reflect the difference between like sort of a symptomatic treatment versus a what's the opposite, like treatment of the root of the problem?
Yeah.
Root cause.
Or at least a more complex treatment, closer mm-hmm. to a root. I think many of these systems may be so complex that we can't get to, or there isn't even
root,
within right. human ken, the root. But going deeper and asking, you know, what other places can I push rather than just going head on at a problem, right? So, you know, in general, going head on at these kind of problems is going to strengthen the very thing that we're trying to solve, right?
So, and I think you and I have had this conversation before too. Maybe an example would be like the form of Aikido, where you're working rather
yeah.
than pushing into the opposing force or whatever that might be. You're finding a different way to use with it or work with
yeah.
it, I guess.
So you're working with the balances that are already in play. And so we can ask this question too. You know, so Henry talks about various kinds of psychological repression. Not that I'm accusing anyone, including Henry, of doing such things. But he's aware of the problem in others, in theory. right? So as we think about these kind of things, or when we're pursuing something in our lives that we never seem to be quite satisfied about, either we just keep wanting more and more, or we keep trying to deny and deny and deny. I think both of those are moving toward the limit of being far from balance, keeping on pushing the pendulum further and further. We can ask ourselves, what is it that that's meant to accomplish? Are we pushing that because we think that that's going to affect something else in the system, right? You know, so by analogy, right, we keep giving more and more and more hunting tags, but still the deer population is growing, still the herbs are being overgrazed. It's not working. Well, why isn't it working? Why isn't that solution addressing the problem? And ask myself, well, what problem am I trying to address? And then what other places might I push something if this isn't working to address that? But that might work at the level of psychology. That might work at the level of human community. That might work at the level of self-cultivation and our own values and priorities just as much. So if there's something that I feel like I'm going and going and going and never quite being satisfied, what imbalance is causing me to pursue that thing? What other imbalances are leading to this one becoming more and more and more imbalanced? And what other things in a complex system are connected to that factor that I might shift the balance of those instead?
I think you could also just say another approach is lessening your attachment.
Okay.
I mean, that's another.
Sure.
Just say if I'm feeling that.
Yeah.
I'm over attached, and so.
Yeah.
I just detach.
Yeah.
Become more of a balance point.
Sure, and I think absolutely that's a really helpful goal.
Or it's a different way of looking at it.
It is, and so maybe what I'm looking, maybe that's the goal, and what I'm suggesting is a means toward that goal. In the sense that, okay, I'm really attached. I don't ever quite feel like I have enough money. Mm-hmm. What other human need is the money maybe standing in for or connected to in some way? I feel like I need money because if I were to fall on hard times, I don't have friends and community that I could trust to be there for me. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's not just I'm not going to be so attached to money, mm-hmm. facing it head on. But it's I'm going to cultivate the friendships that I have amongst my neighbors such that I feel more secure and therefore the apparent need for money feels less pressing. And by doing that, I do in fact cultivate less attachment toward mm-hmm. financial gain. Mm-hmm. But I've done it by finding another thing that I can shift the balance of such that unbalanced desire subsides on its own. I don't have to just say, I'm not thinking about money.
That's
just
not
like
what I meant by not that.
I know it's not, but some people take it that way. Some people take it that way. I've met these people. It's kind of tragic.
I always viewed it as like you're letting go. You're not.
Yeah.
If you're in that mode of you're worse attached to it. If you're thinking about your how much you're not going to be attached to it. It's a paradox.
It is. Yeah. And so sometimes that Aikido move of directing in the third way just puts that energy into a different flow, right? So those kind of things are available to us as individuals. Are there thoughts behind me here and the people hidden by the trees? If not, that's cool. I just don't want to leave you out.
David, would you think of it as like more system-based thinking? Is that what you're? Because
listening
to you talk, what I'm hearing is that like you're taking an issue, but you're taking it's almost, I don't want to use the word long-term thinking, but you are thinking on a bigger time and space scale.
Well, time and or space, in some way, or bringing in more of the factors that are present.
Yeah.
So I do mean, like I said, for all of these stops to be building on each other. Mm. So we start by thinking just whole systems, what flows through them. And so when something is out of balance, what other features of the complex system are holding up that imbalance or are causing that imbalance? And how, by looking at the wider system, do we find ourselves having new options, new levers to work with these things and with these situations? So I think that's just to rephrase what you said, Brian.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
So we're both hearing each other effectively. Cool. So we're going to be I would invite us to reflect on. What kinds of things have these balancing midpoints, right? And, you know, what happens, and how can we work with that principle of rebound sometimes to build something up and then let a flow go all at once, to do work that it couldn't do otherwise? I'm thinking in this context, when I was out here in December, for the first time I was in Montana, Marisa took me to see the crater of Glacial Lake Missoula. Is that familiar to people in general? You know, there's this, you know, this massive freshwater lake that got created by an ice dam at the end of the last ice age. And then all of a sudden, one day, 10 or 12,000 years ago, the dam burst and the water from the flow was allowed to go. And that it was that flow that created the Columbia River Gorge. Going down into Oregon, the Oregon-Washington border there. And on the day that dam burst, the geologists tell us, there was more water flowing through that river than there is flowing in every river and stream on Earth today, right now. Just in that one location. And that Columbia Gorge, and it's a deep and rugged gorge, that was carved basically in a day when that dam burst. I would not have wanted to be on anywhere nearby when that happened, but what an experience. What's that?
From a safe distance.
Much higher up somehow.
Just the sound on that.
Yeah, like the deafening roar. Like, I mean, you go to Niagara Falls or something and hear how loud that is. That's a drop in the bucket compared to this, right? And there have been a couple other flows that have carved it a little bit more since then, but pretty much that gorge was carved at one fell swoop. Unlike a lot of other canyons that were slow erosion over time. So there's a way in which, by damming up all that, look what that was able to do when it was released. So sometimes, you know, building up those funds and then deliberately releasing the imbalance in a particular direction swings so far the other way. Like, what if you wanted a gorge carved in a week, whatever, you couldn't just do it with ordinary trickles of water, right? Not that we're the ones carving gorges. But those kinds of things where we can use a pretty extreme imbalance as a tool to do work, right? Or where other natural processes or community processes do that. So how can we think in terms of the ways in which we build up a certain imbalance? How will this, left to its own devices, come past the midpoint and then settle in? What's that going to do? How is that balance going to reenact itself, reestablish itself? And so that's the third principle that I'm going to invite us to kind of sit with and reflect with. Were there other questions or thoughts before we get walking?
I have one brief thought.
Please, Brian.
So I'm not a scientist, but I read, we're talking to the
kids. Yeah.
I think one of the theory, one theory that is out there, and it kind of ties into this, is that all of the physical laws that we are aware of, like from, mm-hmm. like take the four force, you know,
yeah.
the nuclear force, gravity, electromagnetism,
mm-hmm.
that perhaps all of those which we typically think are fixed features of the universe are actually the result of some greater system that is in a balance at forces mm-hmm. that we don't understand these forces yet.
Yeah.
And that so mm-hmm. really the whole universe is just like this right yeah. now because of some deeper balance point that is yeah. being set. And when that moves, you might not be in an environment with four separate forces. There could be one, or it's going to change, or gravity may not exist in that universe.
Or with physical constants that have different values.
Yeah, those could yeah. all change, but it's interesting because that's just what occurred to me when you're talking yeah. about this whole idea of these points, these balance points.
And that wouldn't come as a surprise to someone who's accustomed to thinking in this way.
Mm-hmm.
Because as we've seen, this keeps happening, all of these whole system things mm-hmm. keep replicating themselves at smaller and higher levels of abstraction. So it would not be a surprise that we could continue going, even to a level that's beyond what human beings are capable of thinking of.
Mm-hmm.
But that if some other kind of creature were to be able to fathom it, mm-hmm. they would notice that. And even if no one could, it would still be doing it.
Mm-hmm.
It would not come as a surprise to someone accustomed to thinking in this way. I mean, obviously, I can't speak that it is that way or not.
Yeah, but, I don't think this might.
But it resonates.
Yeah.
It also resonates with the idea of, you know, like we think of physics as the first science,
mm-hmm.
or you know, our narrow definition of mm-hmm. physics,
yeah.
like the search for those constants as like the fundamental science. Then you mm-hmm. have chemistry, which is derivative of physics, and biology, which is derivative of chemistry, and so
mm-hmm.
on.
Mm-hmm.
But that understanding of the universe, I mean, there's a lot of discussion of a reordering of the sciences where ecology is the first science.
Mm.
And mm. I think that would mm. lend to that notion of even the universe being, and the constants of the universe being dependent on a balance,
mm-hmm.
is a sort of ecological notion that would give credence to that idea of ecology as the first science.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
You know, something occurred to me just then, and again, this might be a kind of a small example, but I'm thinking of all of the animals out there that navigate by tuning into things that we're not even aware of, you know, the Earth magnetism,
mm-hmm.
the polarization of sunlight, and things like that. Now, that's how moths and all these little beasties running around in the woods find their way to where they have to go. And it's a great mystery to us how they do it, but when you look into it, they're tuning into things that are existing all around us
mm-hmm.
that we no. can't even conceive of, hardly.
Yeah.
Scientists might be able to conceive of them, but we can't experience them. And so our own experience of reality is pretty much confined to what our senses are tuned to, and we're actually, through technology and what all, we're narrowing that range even further all the time.
Mm.
So, I don't know, that's kind of a tangent. So.
Yeah.
I just have one question about the idea of putting things out of balance so as to use that rebound.
Yeah.
I wonder if there still can be a distinction between, similar to the squirrel versus Scrooge,
mm-hmm.
Between whether you're doing it to use it or whether you're doing it for its own sake. Like a lot of times mm-hmm. when we repress things,
yeah.
we're not doing it for
right.
that rebound. We're doing it to avoid some other problem or for its own sake or whatever. And similarly to like, you know, to like Scrooge and keeping all his money and whatnot. And I also kind of leads into like what happens when that's not done deliberately. And I mean that idea of the Columbia River, it's like that's destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think that it's the risk of sort of just a rebound that is very destructive rather than constructive.
Yeah.
And there's this quote from, I think, Big Magic, which is a book by Elizabeth Gilbert, who wrote Eat, Play, Love. I don't know, it's an interesting random, I'm taking this out of left field here, but
please.
But she has this analogy of when you're like, that, you know, she has this thesis that everyone is creative, that everyone should express creativity, and that when you don't, you know, it's like having, like, a Rottweiler, a really active dog, that if you're not training that dog and you're not, like, mm-hmm. putting that dog to work, it's going to eat your couch. And she is that same
yeah.
analogy of, like, when you're not, yeah.
No. Absolutely. And so I think the lesson here that this ecological frame gives us is precisely that. You know, whenever you push something, whenever a system gets sufficiently out of balance, sooner or later that rebound is going to come. So if all we're doing is trying to push off to an extreme, to an extreme, to an extreme, the rebound quite likely will come in a way that's unpleasant to us. It'll come in a way that tears away me and all my family in that flood that creates the Columbia Gorge. I mean, the system got back in balance. It was just really unpleasant for anyone who happened to live in the way on that day.
Sounds very timely.
Because there's no yeah. there's no way you're going to outrun that one. Whereas if we're aware, even if as we see imbalances occurring that were not deliberate, or as we're aware of imbalances that we're bringing into our lives, into our communities, into our oikos, our home, right? Knowing that one way or another, this is going to need to rebound as the fund moves into a flow. To be able to be aware of that and ask, is there a way that I can enable the rebound to go in a way that's beneficial to the larger system or to the parts of that larger system I'm especially concerned with? Right, knowing that the rebound is coming anyway. I mean, I think about the surfer getting in a position to ride the wave and not get crushed by it. Mm-hmm. The wave is coming either way. They're coming back to the shore either way, but they're either doing it with it or by it, right? but it's so too with so many other things, right? I'm very much not a fan of damming rivers. It's challenging in a lot of ways. But the more thoughtful builders of dams are going to prepare for the inevitability that the dam is going to fail and design a mode of failure that will be the first thing to fail, and it will be the minimally destructive mode of failure, versus assuming the dam will hold forever. It'll fail on its own in a way that's really catastrophic, versus building in, like, gates that can release the pressure, versus building in side channels that can take some of that flow, or versus building in ways in which that can do useful work when it does finally get unleashed, right? All of those things are the idea of working with the rebound and not getting worked by the rebound or getting worked over by the rebound, or getting out of the way of the rebound, as it may case, but just thinking mindfully about how the fact that that's going to happen versus being blindsided by it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very much in the spirit of the point you raise, Henry. I mean it to be.
Yeah, I definitely.
Okay, cool.
Definitely.